killed, murdered, right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island. Protesters in Minneapolis have attempted to shut down the city's airport this afternoon. The group representing the Black Lives Matter movement blocked two roads outside a terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse.
Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles. Looks like protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown.
Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like if I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Gardner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight. The significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem. It's a New Jersey problem. It's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter. And yes, all lives matter, but black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, Black Lives Matter, you know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance. But I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
On February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida, Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? One reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally manifest, but it was geared toward It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured, if you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk gonna get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured if the police were killing well-to-do white folk, some policemen was going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail. Not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor blind person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
We did have officers jailed for excessive force, and especially in we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations, it appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us, it appears as excessive. But for the officer, at a given moment on the street, it wasn't excessive. And the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police had shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. The only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. What the footage of the convenience store is not very, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African American women have been playing a central role.
And let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story, really.
Like, say hypothetically one or two of these shootings are justified. They don't even give us that opportunity to think, you know, critically about it, because regardless of what happens in the situation, they're not held accountable, which is the part that bothers me the most. It's like, regardless of what's happening, if it's a little boy, unarmed, kid sleeping, a grown man, you know, selling cigarettes, no matter what the police does to them, they're not being held accountable for it.
And there's no data. That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, I mean, because I like Esther's, her list of demands, they kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement, but there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, you know, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, like, the momentum that we have here.
Yeah.
And definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, like, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her. Yeah.
On July 17, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Gardner in a chokehold. Gardner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Gardner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Gardner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Gardner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's, my mom is, you know, all hysterical, crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, "Dad, just stop breathing." So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. you know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet, and would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat on around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop wondering why, you know. I was screaming at the TV, because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes, and it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we've seen on the TV, on the computer, to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just, like, shaky. It was, I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I've never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story, and it was just like, wow. I still can't believe this happened.
The Eric Garner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is the patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since Eric Garner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Breaking news tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on the shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So, who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnbeck, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother
being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes the roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility. But again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person, because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
As you know, Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last ones to have down.
Even within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about colorblindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
So we were just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police, for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's gonna be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a PIT permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit, with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're gonna encounter the same issues that we did with the 4 Mile March. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish. We'll be right back.
Limelight.
COVID researchers are working at breakneck speed to learn about the variant's transmissibility, severity, and ability to evade vaccines. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written jointly by Ewan Calloway and Heidi Ledford Writers. This article is published under the heading, How Bad is Omicron? What Scientists Know So Far? Stay tuned for the details, please. Barely a week has elapsed since scientists in Botswana and South Africa alerted the world to a fast-spreading SARS-CoV-2 variant now known as Omicron. Researchers worldwide are racing to understand the threat that the variant, now confirmed in more than 20 countries, poses to the world. Yet it might take scientists weeks to paint a more complete picture of Omicron and to gain an understanding of its transmissibility and severity, as well as its potential to evade vaccines and cause reinfections. Wherever I go, everyone says, tell us more about Omicron, says Sanjuti Saha, a molecular microbiologist and director of the Child Health Research Foundation in Dhaka, Bangladesh, adding, there is so little understanding of what's going on, and that's true even for scientists. Nature rounds up what scientists know so far about the Omicron variant. How fast is Omicron spreading? Omicron's rapid rise in South Africa is what worries scientists and researchers most, because it suggests the variant could spark explosive increases in COVID-19 cases elsewhere. On December 1st, South Africa recorded 8,561 cases, up from the 3,402 reported on November 26, and several hundred per day in mid-November, with much of the growth occurring in Gauteng province, home to Johannesburg. Epidemiologists measure an epidemic's growth using R, the average number of new cases spawned by each infection. In late November, South Africa's National Institute for Communicable Diseases, NICD, in Johannesburg, determined that R was above 2 in Gauteng. That level of growth was last observed in the early days of the pandemic. Richard Lessels, an infectious disease physician at the University of Natal in Durban, South Africa, told a press briefing recently. Gauteng's R value was well below 1 in September, when Delta was the predominant variant and cases were falling, suggesting that Omicron has the potential to spread much faster and infect vastly more people than Delta, says Tom Wesseliers, an evolutionary biologist at the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium. Based on the rise in COVID-19 cases and on sequencing data, Welsers estimates that Omicron can infect 3 to 6 times as many people as Delta over the same time period. That's a huge advantage for the virus, but not for us, he said. Researchers will be watching how Omicron spreads in other parts of South Africa and globally to get a better read on its transmissibility, says Christian Atlas, a computational epidemiologist at the University of Bern, Switzerland. Heightened surveillance in South Africa could cause researchers to overestimate Omicron's fast growth. But if this pattern is repeated in other countries, it would be very strong evidence that Omicron has a transmission advantage, adds Atlas. If it doesn't happen, for example, in European countries, it means things are a bit more complex and strongly depend on the immunological landscape, so we have to wait. Although genome sequencing is needed to confirm Omicron cases, some PCR tests can pick up a hallmark of the variant that distinguishes it from Delta. On the basis of this signal, there are preliminary indications that cases, although extremely low in number, are rising in the United Kingdom. That's certainly not what we want to see right now, and suggests that Omicron could indeed also have a transmission advantage in the UK, Atlas adds. Can Omicron overcome immunity from vaccines or infection? The variant's swift rise in South Africa hints that it has some capacity to evade immunity. Around one quarter of South Africans are fully vaccinated, and it's likely that a large fraction of the population was infected with SARS-CoV-2 in earlier waves, says Wesseliers, based on heightened death rates since the start of the pandemic. In this context, Omicron's success in South Africa might be due to largely to its capacity to infect people who recover from COVID-19 caused by Delta and other variants, as well as those who have been vaccinated. A December 2nd preprint from researchers at the NICD found that reinfections in South Africa have increased as Omicron has spread. Unfortunately, this is the perfect environment for immune escape variants to develop. How well the variant spreads elsewhere might depend on factors such as vaccination and previous infection rates, says Aris Katsoukas, who researches viral evolution at the University of Oxford. If you throw it into the mix in a highly vaccinated population that has given up on other control measures, it might have the edge there, he said. Researchers want to measure Omicron's ability to evade immune responses and the protection they offer. For instance, a team led by Penny Moore, a virologist at the NICD and the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, is measuring the ability of neutralizing or virus-blocking antibodies triggered by previous infection and vaccination to stop Omicron from infecting cells. To test this, in their lab, her team is making pseudovirus particles, an engineered version of HIV that uses SARS-CoV-2 spike protein to infect cells that match Omicron, which harbors as many as 32 changes to spike. Another South Africa-based team led by virologist Alex Seagal at the Africa Health Research Institute in Durban is conducting similar tests of virus-neutralizing antibodies using infections SARS-CoV-2 particles. So is a team led by Pi-Yong Shi, a virologist at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, who is collaborating with the makers of vaccine to determine how it holds up against Omicron. I was really very concerned when I saw the constellation of mutations in the spike, he says. We just have to wait for the results. Previous studies of Omicron's spike mutations, particularly in the region that recognizes receptors on human cells, suggest that the variant will blunt the potency of neutralizing antibodies. For instance, in a September 2021 Nature paper, a team co-led by Paul Benses, a virologist at Rockefeller University in New York City, engineered a highly mutated version of a spike in a virus incapable of causing COVID-19 that shares numerous mutations with Omicron. The polymutant spike proved fully resistant to neutralizing antibodies from most of the people they tested, who had either received two doses of an mRNA vaccine or recovered from COVID-19. With Omicron, we expect there be a significant hit. If Omicron can dodge neutralizing antibodies, it does not mean that immune responses triggered by vaccination and prior infection will offer no protection against the variant. Immunity studies suggest that modest levels of neutralizing antibodies may protect people from severe forms of COVID-19, says Miles Davenport, an immunologist at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. Other aspects of the immune system, particularly T cells, may be less affected by Omicron's mutations than are antibody responses. Researchers in South Africa plan to measure the activity of T cells and another immune player called natural killer cells, which might be especially important for protection against severe COVID-19.
Aperture.
In 2003, America entered into a war with a country its citizens could barely locate on the map. War was initiated to find Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, something that was never found and actually never even existed. Yet the American invasion of Iraq let the genie out of the bottle, resulting in hundreds of thousands of deaths, the destruction of a whole nation, and insecurity and instability for a region which is continuing until this day. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. As Washington's beating of the war drums raged, Lorna Tychostoup, a single mother and news and politics editor for a local arts magazine in New York, knowingly risks her life, imprisonment, and even a $1 million fine by traveling to Iraq under the threat of war, and on a mission to capture and bring back the face of the Iraqi people for the American public to see. Stay with us for this week's extraordinary and inspiring documentary as Lorna returns with images of ordinary Iraqis that she hopes will sway people against this invasion.
Back then, honestly, I wasn't sure where Iraq was on the map. Nobody I knew where Iraq was on the map. I had never met an Iraqi person, and all I thought was, like, what do they look like? We're going to be killing them. We're going to go to war in a country that I know nothing about, and why? And I really had this sense that if I took enough pictures and I got them in enough places and I showed enough people who the United States would be killing, who we, America, would be killing, that it might help to stop the war from happening. I don't know, I guess I've always been this way. You know, speaking out, I always felt like I was riding the cusp of history. I was watching, I was living history.
You saw the television news pictures of last Saturday's anti-war protest. No one disputes that it was sizable and that, for the most part, it was peaceful.
States of America will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world's most destructive weapons. Any nation that continues to harbor or support terrorism will be regarded by the United States as a hostile regime.
What if your wife or your mother told you that she was headed to Iraq for 2 weeks? Well,
Three New York moms who call themselves the Hudson Valley Peace Brigade are headed there tomorrow for a 10-day mission of what they're describing as peace. Are you going to ask them, why did you guys ignore 17 UN resolutions? Why did you guys wait 12 years? Why do you refuse to disarm your nuclear program, your biological and chemical program? Do you plan on asking them that?
No, I don't. I'm going there to see the people. I'm going there because these people aren't going to be liberated. They're going to be annihilated.
This is left-wing propaganda. You know what? America freed the world from the Nazis. We freed the world from totalitarianism, the former Soviet Union. We freed the world of fascism. And we're going to free these people, the ones you care about. They're going to be liberated.
Listen, I think that when you start dividing it into left and right, that's not the issue here.
But you are a leftist.
Why are we here discussing what our labels are? You can label me anything you want to diminish my argument. I don't want to go to Iraq. I'm going to Iraq because, you know, I feel the people like you, the people who have the money, the networks that have the power, how come they're not going to this country and showing us? They only show us the maniac. They don't show us the faces of the
people. Well, he is a maniac.
People,
I mean, he is a maniac.
Children.
Let's not put that aside.
But
he is a maniac.
There are families there. I would tell our government to please let the weapons inspectors continue to do their job.
Ladies, I wish you get home safe before the war starts, because war is coming. And I mean that sincerely. I hope you get back safe. And coming up, Secretary Ridge raised the threat level to high today. Does this mean you should stay home and lock the doors?
You know, I had always wanted to be on that show because I'll sit here and watch Fox, you know, Hannity and Combs, and want to throw my shoe at the TV half the time because they get people, they interrupt them, they berate them, they just get their message, right? So instead, I interrupted them.
Okay, my name is Lorna Tychosta. I'm going to Baghdad because as a photojournalist, I feel it is my responsibility to go there and bring home the face of the Iraqi people to the American public.
I was wondering if you're concerned about being a casualty of your own government.
I think that right now we're all collateral damage. The Wall Street Journal's poll, 73% of the people in this country do not want unilateral attack of Iraq. We love our country. We live here, too. We are three mothers. We've got six kids between us. We love those kids. We want to come.
The community here has been unbelievably supportive, I think partly because these three women are so brave and bold. But, you know, a lot of people can't go to Iraq. A lot of people can't leave their lives. These three people are risking their lives to go to make a very powerful statement.
You're going to Iraq? What?
I'm going to Iraq.
Really?
So that's why they're filming me.
Why are you going to Iraq?
I met Lorna maybe 10 years ago. She was a single mom, working as a waitress at a local restaurant.
Because we're going to go there as, you know, I'm a journalist, so I'm going to go and take some pictures and bring home some photos and hopefully maybe stop this war insanity.
Lorna is the editor of the political section of Chronogram, a local magazine of arts, culture, politics, kind of the village voice of the Hudson Valley. Lorna has charisma. She has loads of charisma. Lorna has not gone to journalism school. Lorna has not gone to charm school. What Lorna brings to any situation is this almost animal ferocity. She goes after a story like it's nobody's business. She doesn't stop. She'll keep calling people. She wants to know why. Lorna is somebody who knows how to take care of herself very well. And she had said explicitly to me, I have two kids. I love my life. If the war starts to happen, I'm coming home.
My daughter, Lacey, she's 18 and a half years old. My son, Josh, is 22 and a half years old. They both go to the University of Binghamton. They're not happy. You know, they're afraid for me. They're afraid for them. Years ago, like in 95, I traveled in Mexico and I kind of fell into the Zapatista revolution. So I came home and I told them about that. So they've been kind of living like this is what their crazy mom, you know, does.
She's always wanted to go places and see things that I guess she felt that people should see. So I guess you just kind of have to go with it.
The pressure, gosh, the pressure of my kids, that is killer. You know, I know my daughter does not want me to go to Iraq.
Like, whose mom goes over there and why? I mean, besides stuff you see on TV, it's not really something typical of people you know.
I got married very young, and I got married, you know, for ridiculous reasons, because I was trying to please and obtain love from my mother. So I did all the good things. I got married, and then a couple of years later, you're supposed to have kids. I paid my dues.
Like, I want to do things that I want to do.
She always told us from when we were younger that whatever we wanted to do, we could do it. If we wanted to be a coal miner or an artist or whatever, that she would be supportive. It's interesting now that whatever she's doing, I'll support, but I guess that's how it works. She's, like, definitely an irreplaceable person.
The only road all the way across the desert. I've been told that this is a 12-hour journey. The driver drives 100 miles an hour. This, for me, is probably the scariest part of the trip because it looks like it's a vast wilderness of unknown territory. And we're going to end up in Baghdad. I always wanted to go and go to places and see for myself and maybe bring back whatever I saw. I shot 45 rolls of black and white, 30 rolls of color. I get very close to people even if I don't have more than a split second to take their shot. I mean, I live with them after that. I take the shot and then later I see them develop. And they develop within me and I carry them around. February 15th, we had a 200-person international march for peace. We joined the rest of the world. And at one point, it was really interesting. I mean, somebody turned around to me, and they were like, wow, this is like it. Like, the epicenter of the peace movement comes from Baghdad. And then, of course, you know, to go back to the hotel later that night and find out that, you know, 20 to 30 million people around the world had been doing the same thing.
Today in London, 2 million people have marched against this war. That is one out of every 25 human beings in Britain. In Rome, as we speak, there are another 2 million people marching. And in Spain, the third of George Bush's allies in Europe, there are 1 million people marching against the war. Producers that I spoke to, she said that at noon on February 15th in New York City, where all these millions of people were totally shutting down, vast amount of blocks, they get a little phone call from NBC saying, cut the live feed.
Our next guest just returned from a two-week peace mission in Iraq. We all want to welcome Lorna Tychosta back to the show.
You came back from Baghdad. You stayed there for how long? 2 weeks?
I was in Baghdad.
Okay, now, in my opinion, you seem like a lovely woman, but in my opinion, your visit bordered on treason. What were you thinking going there?
Oh, please. You know, I'm an American. I have a constitution. What makes you think that I should not be able to travel someplace on this planet? We have freedom of speech. This is a free country. You're telling me that this is treason?
If you oppose America's policies, that's fine. You can protest here all you want because that's free speech protected under the First Amendment. That's fine.
No, I'm an American.
But to carry your protest to enemy territory when we are on the eve of war seems to me villainous and bordering on treason.
Well, that makes great play here on TV.
Was aiding and abetting the enemy?
Absolutely not. I'm an American.
My going there was illegal. So what is it? Up to $1 million and 12 years in jail for going someplace and bringing back the truth?
And I guess it comes down to the fact that if we were all sitting here and we were about to be bombed, I'd certainly want some group to rise up and make it not happen.
I'm in the process of setting up a college tour. I'll go around the country even if I have to and show these photos. And I really think that even people who want war, once they look at these photos, there will be people who will change their minds. There's nothing in the country. They have raw sewage floating in the streets. There was such poverty, such desolation. You can see the stress in the eyes of every Iraqi person. You see the
this exhaustion and this fear. And the American public has to go and see. I think they have to go to Iraq and see this for themselves. Don't listen to me. You know, don't take my word on it.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. We will defend our freedom. We will bring freedom to others, and we will prevail. May God bless our country and all who defend her.
I believe in war. I believe there are times when you need to defend your land, your home. I don't think this was one of those times.
I was actually in the dark room the night that we started bombing.
It kind of stunned me that at that point, like a silence swept across the land. It stunned me that I felt I wanted to be silent too. If any of them are dead, they'll still live. And I think that's why I made so many, so that like everybody who has them, in some way, they won't be forgotten. I wanted it to be true, that the Iraqis were happy we were there, that the fighting was going to stop now, and that we could have peace and things would be better. Like a little kid, I wanted it to be okay.
In Baghdad today, the search continued for Iraq's weapons of mass destruction.
So growing concern here, they won't find the massive quantities of weapons that were the major justification for the war.
The one thing I felt was missing from my work were the stories of the soldiers. That summer, I drove to North Carolina to Camp Lejeune to interview Marines. Half of what I do, or more than half of what I do, is because I take it to the personal. Like, I don't want my kids going to fight some old rich man's war.
Are these Americans who are so frightened that they're sending these children off to fight for them, are they willing to look at the photographs that they bring home of the dead bodies that they've killed? We don't want to look. We don't want to see. Send them off. Let somebody else fight for us so that we'll be safe. I think that that's a crime. I think that's a criminal activity. What do we do? You know, what do we...
We should never win it.
We should never win it.
Period. And just let the country be.
My son was in the invasion and when we invaded Iraq in the beginning of the war. He was a driver of a 3rd Humvee in line going to Baghdad. His battalion was part of the battalion that got pinned down in Nasiriyah for 11 days in a firefight. During the war, didn't sleep. I became a CNN Fox News addict. Finally, I just had to turn the TVs off. He came back with 11 ribbons. A lot of souvenirs, a lot of pictures, a lot of nightmares. To this day, he still has them. Because you don't hear anything about the guys that came back, what's missing the legs, the arms, and stuff like that. You know, there's nothing in the media, there's nothing in the newspapers, nobody talks about it. What are you going to do, you know? Say a prayer.
You know, I went in the beginning to bring home the face of the Iraqi people. Now I want to go and bring home the face of the soldiers, because that's got to hit home here.
The armored personnel vehicle that I drove around with, I went out on patrol. We left at 3 o'clock in the morning. This is probably the worst experience of my entire life. So we rode around in this heavy-duty tin can that was spewing diesel fuel out of here. Over here, there's a hatch that you can stick your head out of. You want to see the bullets and mortars coming at you. There was no heater in the vehicle. They had had a heater. It had broken. You know, these guys are driving around. It's very cold there, and they don't need your goddamn ribbon. They need you to send them some money for a heater, or at least to write your congressman and your congresswomen and say, could you please make sure our troops are being taken care of over there? And they need letters. They need emails. They love it. They want to know that America even knows they're there. So we rode around the village, you know, waiting to be shot at. You know, we got back around 11 o'clock in the next morning. That night when I tried to sleep, my body hurt more than it's ever hurt from any flu I've ever had in my entire life. And I think it was a combination of riding around in a heavy-duty tin can and also that I had poisoned myself with adrenaline. Because at any given moment, we were told, you know, we could be shot at.
How do they feel?
They're
streets. I spoke to some who are terrified. They're being shot at. They're under threat of mortars landing on their bases, car bombs going off around them. You know, most of the ones I spoke to want to come home. And do you know that there's a law that this particular, that the Bush administration has enforced? The Clinton administration didn't enforce it. That you cannot film or in any way capture the caskets with the flags on them. We're not allowed to see this. The media is not allowed to capture these images. That's a good question. Well, I don't know. Why? Should you not be seeing death on your TV?
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.